What I want to do today is quickly outline some of the ways that the study of God's Word has begun to shape and influence the work that we're doing at Advanced Methodist where I work among the poor. So I am a student. I am interested in the role of biblical scholarship and all these things. I'm going to have a really hard time sticking with this mic, so you might see me moving away from this. But more importantly, I come as a practitioner, and so all of these thoughts are things that are playing out in the real world for us, and I want to make sure I move quickly so we can get to all that. So this is going to be an outline. It's not going to be in depth, but it's the direction that I think we need to go if we're going to continue to find a way to let the Bible out, let Scripture really speak to us as we consider our economic lives in the West. So I want to begin by outlining a difference between what I'm calling charity economics and kingdom economics. So if you think about what the way that we traditionally think about caring for the poor, and you think about all the different ways that you've probably been asked to care about the poor, most of them fit into a model of what I'd call traditional charity, which focuses exclusively on asking the question, what good things can we do with the money and resources that are already in our pockets? So it takes as a given wealth, money, financial resources, and then it asks the question, what good things can be done with that? Any sort of traditional charity, from clothes drives to food banks, typically operates out of this model. But I think when we look at the text, and particularly the Old Testament, we find economic concerns, what I'm calling kingdom economics, that don't just focus on the good things we can do with the money in our pockets, but actually spend a lot of time looking at how the money gets there in the first place. So there's a ton of concern, if you look at this kind of hokey picture that I have up here, of this factory and the horse and all that. Old Testament economics is not just concerned with wealth, it's concerned with the method of production of wealth. And it's concerned about the factory itself, it's concerned about the guy who works at the factory, it's concerned about, in this kind of quaint picture, the horse that draws the buggy to the factory, and is concerned about the land on which the factory is built. And that perspective has enormous implications for how we think economically in our lives, particularly in the church. And I want to think about some things that come from trying to think about this bigger perspective. So that's what we're talking about. Before we can get to any kind of practical thing, I want to talk about what I really see as the foundation for thinking more holistically about economics, and that foundation is that God gives. The foundation for any thinking about economics in the church has to be that the entire economic equation is based on God's good gift of the abundant creation to his people. And we see that throughout the Bible, but I want to look at three specific ways.
Your wireless mic, because we're trying to record
this. Oh, sorry. I have difficulty being tied down. We see this throughout the Bible, this gift that God has given, but I want to look at three quickly examples. And the first one, obviously, is creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the thing that I find so beautiful recently about the creation story is the way that the earth itself is fecund. It's productive. And so you get these beautiful passages where the water is teeming. Let the water teem with life. Let the earth teem. So you get this picture of this productive, incredibly vibrant, almost living creation that God has given to us. And yet the task of humanity is to bring all of that potentiality into flourishing. And so we see right there in the beginning this idea that God has given the good earth and humans the task of stewarding that good gift in such a way that it flourishes to its highest potential. So we see God's gift ultimately in creation. We also see it in the wilderness. You know, after the fall, one question that I think we would ask economically is, what does it mean for God's good gift to suffer the effects of human sin? There's a sense in which, will God's gift still be good? Will it still be productive? How will it create abundance for us when the land has been cursed and by the sweat of our brow we'll work it? And we see that indeed God continues to give in the wilderness. Remarkable story of manna in the wilderness, because Israel has just been brought out of the most powerful economy of its day in Egypt, a very high-tech economy. The work of Ellen Davis on this agriculturally is very interesting, talking about how technologically savvy and yet oppressive the Egyptian economy was. But the result is this seeming abundance, the leeks and all that stuff that they're complaining about just about as soon as they get across the Red Sea. And so the question for Israel is, what's going to happen to us economically in the wilderness? And the answer is, God's going to provide through manna. And so every day, there's this incredible reminder that God is totally oriented towards gift. The economy, the daily life of Israel is totally dependent on God's continuous giving in the wilderness. Some interesting things about manna, you have to gather it. You have to go out and gather it up. And yet, there's this remarkable thing that Paul picks up on, that the one who gathers a lot doesn't have too much. And the one who gathers little doesn't have too little. And I take that as a principle that God's gift provides for all in a way that's generally equitable. And I think that's an important point that's picked up throughout the text. And so you see that. And then another point is that when they try to hoard that manna, when they pursue a way of interacting with the gift that is based on acquisition and covetousness, it just rots. And if any of you have read Shane Claiborne, he talks about how he wishes some of our Wall Street bank accounts worked this way. That the manna that they hoarded would just rot, and then we could figure out what better to do with it. But it's an interesting point. So God gives in creation, he gives in the wilderness. And lastly, and this is going to be important for what we talk about later, God gives in the land. And this is for the Old Testament Israel. This is the preeminent gift. That God takes this landless, wandering people and brings them into the promised land. A land that mirrors the original creation in the sense that it's flowing with abundance, with milk and honey. And the line from the story that has just hammered me as I've thought about this over the last year is where repeatedly God says, I'm bringing you into a land with wells you did not dig, vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. And what he's saying is that I am bringing you into an economic abundance that is based totally on my gracious giving. You did not earn it. It does not belong to you by rights, but it is a gift. And in the way that God brings them into the land with the allotment of land, that gift is distributed equitably among families. So that just as in the story of manna in the wilderness, the gift is given to be shared and experienced by all. Three examples of how God's economy is based on gift. But that gift creates responsibility. And so when we look, one of the things that I'm going to talk about today and argue is that Chris Wright talks about using Old Testament Israel as a paradigm for ethics. So the idea is that in Israel we have a paradigm. It's not a rule. It's not something to be repeated by rote. You can't just pick it up and set it down in the middle of Hamilton tomorrow. That's not going to work. But it does give us an example of a cohesive system under God's rule by which we can judge our own economic activity, our own ethical activity, and which can inspire us to just economic activity in the present. So we're going to look at the way that Old Testament Israel, two examples of how Old Testament Israel gives us a paradigm for just economic activity. Because this gift that God gives in the land, in the wilderness, it creates responsibility, and specifically economic responsibility. So two examples, okay, and you can do this with a million things. So again, I'm sketching kind of a method more than giving a whole bunch of solutions because there are all sorts of paradigms. There are ecological paradigms and all the rest. But I want to look at two that have a lot to say about our own economic system. And the first one is the gleaning laws. I'm sure you guys have heard of these. We find them in Leviticus 19 and 9 and following. And we see an example of them in the story of Ruth. But the essential idea with gleaning laws is that the family farm, when it's being harvested, you only go over it once, and you don't go over it all the way to the edges. And the reason that you do that is because you're leaving what's left over, the grapes that you accidentally pass over, or the stuff growing over there by the fence line, for the most vulnerable, the orphan, the widow, and the stranger, the alien, the immigrant. You leave it for them so that they can come behind, and they can work your fields, and they can eat off the fruit of your land. Now, if you're like me, we're not in an agricultural economy anymore, so this doesn't quite have the pop that it should. I'm thinking of my garden that I have at my home and how lousy it is and how it hardly produces anything, and none of my neighbors want my tomatoes, and I could leave all of it there for them to pick, and they'd be like, I don't want any of that, you know what I mean? So this doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but remember, in an agrarian economy, land is the business. This is the family business. Land is the factor of production. And so what we have is a situation in which the family is willingly accepting lower profits in order to create work that provides zero benefit to to the business owner. They're leaving profits behind to create work that provides zero benefit to the business owner, so that every member of Israelite society can gain a living by their own work. Tremendously interesting. Very challenging. And when you think about this, this is not the most efficient way to do things economically. Most of our Western economies are based on the idea that if you expand the pie, there's more to help everybody. And so if you create a system where there are a bunch of people at the top, as long as the pie gets bigger, you can just tax them and distribute it, right? I mean, certainly it would be more efficient for the best landowners to just harvest everything, and then they can give stuff away. But God won't have any of that. He won't have any of that. He wants, as a stopgap measure for the most vulnerable, that they are able to provide for themselves on a daily basis through their own work. We see that in Ruth. Beautiful story. And when we bring that into our own day, we contrast that commitment to providing an opportunity for the poor to provide for themselves through work with an economy that is totally brutal to the people at the bottom. Now, I'm from America, so you know some of my applications you're going to have to worry about, and you also may be suspicious of my accent and all that. So if I say something about us and you think, not us, then I'm sorry, okay? I get it. When I was in Europe, everybody wore Canadian flags on their backpacks. I said, why do you guys all do that? I said, so they don't think we're you. And I was like, so anyways, I get it. But listen, where I live, if you came to my neighborhood, in contrast to a community with gleaning, you would see tremendous unemployment. Double digits, 10, 20, 30% unemployment. You would see tremendous barriers to even getting on the economic ladder. Because we have a system in America that creates huge numbers of felons and then creates a situation where it's almost impossible for those felons to have work. We've created an educational system which systematically deprives the people at the bottom from being able to provide themselves for their own work. We have a welfare system that at times disincentivizes work. We have a drug trade which disincentivizes work. And we have a long legacy of racial oppression that makes it hard for people in my neighborhood, one of the poorest areas in our state, to begin to provide for themselves their own work. And so we see a tremendous difference. High unemployment, many jobs, and then the problem of low wages. We have tremendous numbers of jobs that will not provide enough for a family ever. Never. 50 hours a week. Totally different. Totally different ethic, totally different ethos from a society committed to gleaning. Another paradigm, and of course you've also heard this, is the Jubilee. Every 50 years, people who bought family farms would give them up so that people who'd lost them could get them back. God basically said, I'm going to distribute my land equitably, and then you can lose it. You really can lose it up to 50 years. And if you lose your land and you're subject to all sorts of economic difficulties, you've got this gleaning thing and some other things going on to help you. But one day, 50 years later, you come back into your inheritance because ultimately you're all my tenants anyways. I'm the owner of the land and I want it distributed equitably. Now, this is tremendous because we've been hearing, it's a 50-year reset button. And we've been hearing about this a lot, but one thing that we forget is it's not just access for people who've lost lands. It is that, but it requires, that access comes from the people who've acquired the land. So when I gave this talk recently at a missions conference, I said, this is me. I'm a drunkard and a slob. I violate all the proverb laws and I lose my land because I'm totally unfaithful and I'm just a jerk and I just run my farm into the ground and I lose it. And this guy over here is the wise farmer who stewards his resources well, who works the land, who saves up so that he can leave an inheritance to his sons who are a blessing from the Lord. And one day, his sons will have to give up something that they've acquired so that my sons have an equal shot at economic stability and prosperity in the land. Remarkable. And when we think about this in our current economic terms, we see that ownership by the people, while upheld as a good, was not as important as the good of the entire society regularly having access to the primary sources of production. So there's a reset button. What this does is it cuts off multi-generational poverty, which is a tremendous issue in the U.S., And the way that it deals with multi-generational poverty is by hedging multi-generational affluence. It puts a cap on the capital that you can acquire in order to make sure that the people on the lowest always have access. Remarkable. Now, when we think again about our own world, of course you know about the widening gap between rich and poor, and you also know about the difference not just between income but in wealth. So the main difference between me and my neighbors is what I get every 2 weeks. Yes, on my check it's bigger, but it's also the wealth that I own a home, that I own a car, that I own assets that stabilize. And that gap, the wealth gap, is much larger even than the widening income gap. And so we see that our economy does not live up to this principle. So what does this mean for us today? Well, that's the Old Testament, right? Okay. So I've got this whole section I'm going to skip, but let me just tell you, if you think it's just the Old Testament, you're going to have to trust me, it's not. Jesus, the early church, they talked about their ministry in terms of Jubilee. They practiced divestment in the line of Jubilee. James talks about wages and workers' rights. So this is a theme that's picked up in the New Testament, which you're just going to have to rush through. So what does this mean for us today? Well, when I give this talk in the U.S., everyone waves their finger at me and cries, socialist. So I don't know if you're doing that, or maybe you think I sound too much of a conservative or something. But the point here is that Israel's primary relevance as a paradigm is for the church. And so the problem in America, and you're going to have to adapt this to your own context, is that on the right, we idolatrously put our hope in the invisible hand. On the left, we idolatrously put our hope in the welfare state. And the truth is that God calls his church to make work work as his people did, using the resources that they have in our own day. So how can we do that? So what I'm suggesting is that the church takes on this task of making work work. Here's some things that Advance is doing. We're trying to make work work in our context. So we offer job training programs. We work with a network of churches to provide referrals for job openings, particularly jobs that will work with ex-felons and people with low education. And we've started a staffing service to help people who would not have a shot to get in the door otherwise, So we have companies with a no-felon policy, but they'll let a staffing service put whoever they want in there. And we use that as a way to make sure that people who've been through the prison system can get back on their feet. We are working to create access to jobs for people in our community, not just through training, but by asking the question of our Christian businessmen to take seriously the responsibility of hiring and job creation, that sort of thing. We're also working on the asset issue, because remember, gleaning the low-wage job today that puts food on my table is a stopgap to the Jubilee, where assets get redistributed. So in addition to the job challenge, we're also trying to take aim at the asset question. So we're doing several things on this front. The first is, in our economy, one of the most important assets is education. So we are spending a lot of time and resources helping high school dropouts earn their high school equivalency. And it's one of the great joys of my life to see people who've been regretting a decision they made for 10 or 15 or 20 years get to experience that Jubilee reset button by getting the asset of education back, which at least in our economy opens up tremendous potential for earning that is not there without it. We are also offering financial literacy classes tied to match savings programs. So if you come through our financial literacy class and you qualify, you decide you want to save for an asset, a house, car, down payment on a house, small business, or to go back to school, you can save $1,500 and we will match that $1,500 with $3,000. And the reason that we're doing that is we're saying some of the excess lands that the wealthy have acquired need to come back to the people who have lost those lands to help them achieve stability and economic success in the community. Another thing that we're doing, two other really exciting things that we're doing, and I'm running out of time. One is we are launching an entrepreneurship class, which is another way to try to help workers become owners. Because there seems to be this idea, both in Israel and today, that ownership in one form or another creates greater stability, a greater opportunity for wealth, a greater opportunity for economic flourishing. So we'll be starting an entrepreneurship class in the spring. We're modeling that off for a group in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that's helped over 40 businesses, small businesses, start in the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of them among poor communities, as a way to think about how do we pursue just distribution of assets. We're also exploring the issue of worker-owner cooperatives, which I think is one of the most exciting ways within our economic system to embody just distribution of resources, because every worker in a worker-owner cooperative is an owner. And so they invest with their labor, and they make decisions as a co-owner, and they receive profits as a co-owner. And it's a great way that today, right in the middle of the system that we have, we can enable people to get access to ownership. Some of you are business majors in here. I would challenge you to go look at Mondragon, M-O-N-D-R-A-G-O-N, in Basque region of Spain. One of the most successful corporations in all of Spain has been operating on a one-worker, one-vote policy for 60 years. Surprise, surprise, it started with a Catholic priest investing in a poor community. Check out Mondragon, Spain, and if you're a business person, go figure that out. What does this mean for us? Well, there's all sorts of things that we can do. And I just want to say here, I'm gonna move on, because a lot of these are specific to my particular group, to this point, which is that what you've got up here right now before you is a guy with a minor in economics, okay, who really likes hanging out playing dominoes with poor people and likes to study the Bible. Not the solution to our economic problem, right? It's not me. What the church needs is to enlist all of the talent of our real estate agents, our entrepreneurs, our financial analysts, of the entire community, and make this question of how do we create a world where work works for the poor, the question. All of the creativity that we are losing is in the church is amazing. So a lot of what I'm doing is saying, I don't know what you're studying, but for the love of God, take some of this and bring it into what you're doing and figure out how to start the next worker-owner cooperative movement. Or figure out how to take on rental reform in your community. Or figure out how to help the education system. But this is a tremendous question, and I'm convinced that as Christians, if we take our responsibility to make work for the poor seriously, there's no telling what can happen, and there's no telling what you in this room will come up with. Simply taking the premise that God has given, His gift is enough for abundance for all, and if we live into His paradigm, we can experience that. And then the two things quickly, and then I'm done. The first is, remember, I said this earlier, the economic prosperity in the West is based on endless growth. That's what it's based on. In my country, it doesn't matter whether you're right, left, or center, that's the goal. And in the Bible, prosperity is not based on endless economic growth. It's not based on the market. It's not based on the government. It's based on sacrificial, community-oriented generosity that creates opportunity for everyone. So I would challenge you to take the economic problem spotlight off of wherever you put it, whether that be the government or Wall Street, and put it on yourself and on your church and ask, how do we answer this problem? And finally, the good news. We live in expectation of the kingdom economy coming surely and definitely because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A day is coming when everyone will sit under their own vine and fig tree and no one will make them afraid. When the kings of the earth bring the wealth of nations into the New Jerusalem. When everyone is flourishing in their place with God's people before God. That's the economy that is coming. And our work is done in the shadow of that coming economy. And what we do when we work hard in light of God's word to create a more just economy, we make that coming day more believable for the world, and particularly for the poor. We create a world where the poor can smell and taste and hear the kingdom of God. And that takes us to the heart of evangelism and discipleship. So we don't do this work out of guilt, and we don't do it out of fear. We do it in the sure hope that Jesus is bringing this economy, and we're going to live into it a little bit in the present. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I've taken a little bit more than my time.
Thank you, Michael. It was superb and very stimulating. Bob. Michael, can we rescue the microphone?
Oh, sure. You have to find it first.
I think this just goes in your pocket.
The sharing already begins with microphones. Huh?
Yeah.
I liked very much your introduction. I have to confess that only this morning we made for the first time acquaintance. We had some correspondence, but that was not seeing each other directly. But I feel very much at home about what we heard, and my only effort will be to generalize it, to make it even more than just a message for the church. I think that restriction has to be taken out. It is more. But I think that we will agree later on. Maybe an intriguing question. Was the Old Testament economy, as it is described in the Torah, was it meant to work as an economic system? Usually, if you read textbooks about that, then it is said that the Old Testament economy was just, let us say, a Middle East agrarian old economy. And then something was added, like, for instance, a gleaner principle, a Jubilee principle. But in the root, it was just a normal Middle East economy. I think we both say no. It was far more. It was an economic coherent system on its own. If you want a kind of reference for that, for me an intriguing test you find in, I think, Deuteronomy. That is chapter 23, verse 20, where it is said that in a country in which interest is not the principle, it is among Israelites, you may not ask interest, that it is accepted that you ask it from foreigners. Now, that seems a discriminatory text. Why not for foreigners, including in that? But of course, the economic consequence, it is kind of interdisciplinary discussion. Because if foreigners could just borrow money at a price of zero interest, then the whole capital base of the own Israeli economy would be broken down. It was a protection measure to save your own economy in its own character against just the interference of foreigners taking away your capital. So that is already an indication that his economy was intended to be a working economy. And now it becomes really interesting, because if it is an economic system in its own, then we have to compare it with, let us say, it's a plan economy, the communist economic system, and the market economy as a capitalist economic system, and see how far this economy is different from that as an economic system. And now my hypothesis is that we always speak about the deep difference between a plan economy and a market economy, but in the view of the Bible, they have far more similarity than we usually think they do have. That similarity is something which is different from the principles of the Old Testament economy as an economic system. I will try to illustrate it by just looking, now speaking as an economist, about what is called the factors of production. You find in each economic textbook that the economy is having three factors or four factors of production. That is labor, it is capital, and it is land or nature. In the combination of them, you can make products and produce things which can be sold or can be given to consumers. And then the principle of, let us say, market economies and plan economies is to maximize the output. If you have the most efficient combinations of land, labor, and capital, you come to the highest level of products, which is so maximizing economic growth, also explained by Michael. But now, the remarkable thing in this economic system is that it is more input-oriented. It gives, also in the rules of the Torah, it gives a great significance to the fact that labor should be honored and have a dignity of human labor, which also includes rest, also for the foreigners, that it is that the working situations should be also dignified, and that, for instance, if there is an element of slavery also in that economy, but if your employer gives you with his fist in your face and you are losing one tooth, then you're already free. There is a protection of labor in its conditions. But the same is true for the land. The land should have its rest every 7 years. So that's a manure, that has a cattle comes in, and the manure of the cattle makes it possible that a new cycle of 6 years is coming to use this land. The land is treated with care, and God stands at the side of the land to protect it, even if his own people are misusing it. Then they go in exile, because the text says God wants the sabbatical years back, which have not been implemented. God stands at the side of the land. But also capital. It is freely at disposal of people who need it, and you have to give it to them without asking interest. In the economy of Israel, that was possible because possibilities to invest in an agrarian economy were limited, and also the possibilities of saving, saving capital were available, so the interest level could have a level of zero. And so it could be just be liberated as an input to help also poor people to loan, to be a lender for some time if they had problems. Now, if you have that economy, then you feel that the concept of efficiency is a different concept as we are using it in our modern world. Here the economy is oriented to the dignity and the value, the inherent value, as Max Weber told about the inherent value of what we call the factors of production, because we see it as only instrumental for the goal of production, but there it is honored to be a valuable element, labor and land and capital, for the living of ordinary people, which implies that the horizon is not the maximum output, but the feast. If we have you have a party, then usually we after one day of feasting we are collapsing. But in Israel it was 7 years. You had to take the widows and the Levites with you to Jerusalem and then have a full week of feast. That was the horizon of the Israeli economy. So there is an abundance growing, because God blesses the land, and in that blessing of the land, if you do your work, there is an abundance, and that abundance is a reason to have joy. That is something different from our economies. Because our problems in our Western economy are precisely at the input side. We have a lack of stewardship in relation to nature. The species are dying. We are misusing nature. Labor, often unemployed. And if it is employed, sometimes in its working situations, because of maximum profitability and efficiency, which has lost their human quality. And capital is available for the rich and not for the poor. So you see that, and that is the root of the growing distinction between wealth and poverty and income, from between the rich and the poor world, that the poor cannot just borrow money for the price which they need, and that's the price of zero. So our problems are related to the maximization of what we call wealth, material products, and we are just ignoring, losing the quality of inputs where the biblical economy is having its foundation. Maybe one other remark. There is a last lesson. Maybe far more, but I mentioned only one. the economy was intended to work, and but also you see that in practice, if an economic system is working, that sooner or later problems are arising. People can go in the way of corruption. They also can be harsh in relationship to working situations. And therefore, in that system of the law, you see that the land has its right to be treated well. Laborers are treated, have a right to have an escape route. But also, you see that those elements of production, that they can, after some time, go a path which was not intended by the good Lord. What is the lesson? And then the sequence of sabbatical years comes in, and also of the year of Jubilee. Why let me say it in this word. We think about an economic system that it has to be perfect, which this implies that it has to be immune for human shortcomings. But that system, it does not exist. Every economic system is built under some presuppositions of what you call human responsibility. Otherwise, it cannot work. But then comes the healing power of the year of Jubilee. And it begins with the Day of Atonement, so which is a day of forgiveness of sins, but it seems as if it also radiates to economic life. Jürgen Moltmann here mentions in his book about God and God and creation the term of Yeshina. Yeshina is the entering of God in corrupt and sinful societies. Because Jubilee means that at a certain moment in time, after the sequence of seven times seven sabbatical years, the next year is the year in which poor families have to be given. It is a law, it is not just a question of ethics, but it's a law. They have to be given back their original property as family. There is a rule in the law that their debts are just cancelled. Every sabbatical year is a year of the cancellation of debts. And also there is an obligation that they will be given the tools, the machinery, so to say, to work with the land. So just imagine that you are a very poor family, and that the year of Jubilee comes, and then you have your land back, your debts are cancelled, and you have the tools to have it start a new life. And that is something of, let us say, atonement of economic life. So Lord God enters into corrupt economies, and then we have to listen. And the churches in Latin America, it is a symbol of the horn blowing. They ask for the year of liberation of the Lord, also for the depressed and poor countries. That was a message of the churches some years ago. So churches may also ask for the liberation of our present economies and say, we have lost our ways, we should be more input-oriented and forget our idolatry with always maximizing our output. That is not good. That is what the similarity of market and plan economies have in common. But the Lord has more wisdom than human beings often have. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you, Bob and Michael. I mean, very, very stimulating, incredibly rich. And so I think you could see that this is important stuff. So we have time now for questions. And I don't know if one of you would like to sit on the chair and the other one would stand. But if you want to come up, and then, yeah, why don't you bring the chair for Bob? And so we're going to take 10 minutes for questions. and then we'll stop and see if we've still got the room and if we want to carry on for discussions. I particularly encourage the students to ask their questions, but of course any questions are welcome. Okay, yes.
You talk about the Israeli economy as self-sustaining, but nowadays we live in an international economy where we talked about having to charge interest to foreigners because that the foreign interaction with the Israeli economy would degrade the amount of capital and it wouldn't be able to sustain itself. So how is there a practical way to implement these ideas in an international setting? Because not everyone is going to jump on this.
Thank you for your question. If you look to the international distribution of labor and income and wealth today, then there is indeed a general conclusion that while there is of course economic growth in the countries of the south of the world, that the gap between rich and poor is widening, because in the dynamics of the economy, there is an enrichment taking place, which also can lead to impoverishment. Usually we use the terms richness and poverty as static terms. But in a dynamic world, you see that while the northern countries and their banks are enriching themselves, that there is a kind of economic causality going on, which leads to, in the long run, to more poverty in the most poor regions of the world because of the lack of access to capital. If we now listen to that rule that you have to protect your economy from being too dependent from foreign influences, that to some extent that is also the Mosaic law, then you can also say that the poor countries in the south should be entitled as the right also to say that there should not just be a totally free entry of companies of the West having their investment in your economy, while there are possibilities, for instance, in Indonesia, a rich, resource-rich country, also to build up your own economy with your own kinds of investments. So sometimes then Abraham Kuyper, he gave a lecture about what he calls the holy order, in which he said that in liberalism you have the idea that the world economy should be always totally free, but that he said every nation should have a possibility to protect its own population for a too strong orientation to international economy. That it led to a deep conflict in the anti-revolutionary party, but that party has so many conflicts that they could handle with that. So that's the first remark, right to protect your economy. But the second is that in the international situation of finance and of capital, there is now a growing dominion of financial markets, which are just controlling the world economy. And then another element comes in, the element of justice. Usually the question is restricted to the question, how can we use money responsibly? But the economic question is, also in the Torah, how did money originate? Where does it come from? Does it come from the side of already rich nations and rich banks which can multiply money? Or should the poor have a say, an element in the creation of money itself? And that question is usually very negatively answered. So rich banks, rich nations want to have the fruits of their money production fully for themselves, and then give it afterwards to the poor. But poor people, poor nations should be entitled to have already from the very start an element of benefit from It's a new money which has created this world. Maybe a far too long answer.
No, but excellent.
Can you give me that problem with an example? What does that mean?
Okay, what does that mean? Could you give an example?
That's a risk, it's that we go in details, but I'll give it a try. Do you know about so-called special drawing rights? That is a possibility which is the International Monetary Fund. It can make, it's, you can see it as a kind of international money, which the IMF can just make. But the rule by which that new money is now distributed, if there is, let us say, a creation of special drawing rights, is that it is called the rule of James, that everyone who has will be given, and what has not will not be given at all. Because it is the distribution of that is just the opposite of what Michael just said. It is that the distribution is at 99% of the newly money created by the IMF. Is going straightly to the rich nations. Because it is given in a ratio of your export volume and the volume of your gross national product. So poor nations have no chance to have a part of it.
Okay. You know, Will, it looks to me as though there is another class coming in here. So what we'll do is we'll take one more question. And then can I ask you to take your cups and we'll take your question. If you can take your cups and that back to where they came from. And if any of you want to continue the discussion, we'll do that in 212D. So we have one more question from here.
This question's from Michael. You talked a bit about being a Jubilee, but I think the most practical thing for students and for people in our economy is probably Sabbath. I don't know if that's something you can touch on a bit about. The Sabbath and its relation to economics, and can you elaborate more on that? I don't know if you can touch on that.
No, yeah. That's not something I've done a lot of thinking about, but I do think that, like with the principle of, you see the Sabbath with manna, right? And part of the deal there is that you can't go out and work when it's time to rest because it doesn't work. And I think there's an assumption in the way that we live our lives that not only is it possible, but that it's good to push ourselves towards constant production, cycles of production and consumption, because we're aiming towards excess instead of what I'm going to write down on my wall from Dr. Hoetzfarb, that the horizon is the feast. So I do think that one thing that we need to do is we need to find ways of production and consumption that don't dominate our lives to such an extent that we can't be citizens in any other way. And of course that means Sunday Sabbath rest. But I also oftentimes wonder if we really took this seriously, if we wouldn't see more families having people taking part-time jobs and saying no to certain sorts of career norms simply because they don't fit that idea that we were created for cycles of work and rest, and that actually creates abundance. One thing I wanted to say was that Dr. Hoetzfarb has talked a lot about idolatry, and the irony to me is that in the Bible, God promises abundance for obedience. Now, I'm not talking about the prosperity gospel kind of way, but what I'm saying is that God promises that if his creation is stewarded wisely, there is enough. So when we embrace the market or a command economy, a control economy, as the necessary step to get abundance, that is idolatry. And is the same as worshiping an idol. Because we're saying, what God has promised he cannot do, but this idol that I can manipulate of the market, the economic activity, and the social, that can provide. And Sabbath jams a spoke in that wheel. And so it's an important one.
Okay. Well, a provocative note on which to end. So I should tell you that last night, Michael was repeatedly practicing pronouncing Hoetzfarb. So, and you didn't do bad today. But we should thank them both, and then if you want to continue a bit of discussion, room 212D.
So superb.
So much of my thinking has been directed at the individual and the small community, and I find so much help from the world thinking about that.
Thanks very
much. Thanks for your time.
Okay.